So modern science actually hasn't been around that long, really. You know, modern science has really only been around 200-300 years, something like that, in terms of how we understand modern science. It was more really called philosophy, really, or natural philosophy before then. But we're living in an age now where science is kind of all-powerful in some ways. In some ways, you know, a lot of the population really don't want to believe anything that science hasn't proven 100%. And actually, even when science proves things 100%, actually, the population doesn't always want to believe them. It can actually take quite a long time. This is called paradigm shifts, really, when there's a big shift in the understanding of what works or what doesn't work. This happened back in the 1500s, 1600s, when, of course, previous to that, everyone used to think that the whole universe revolved around this little blue planet, of course. And it actually took about 150 years of a variety of different scientists and philosophers, obviously Galileo being one of them, but there was quite a few others, who actually kept saying, no, guys, hang on, this is not the case. The universe does not revolve around this planet. And, of course, a few people almost got executed because of having that kind of statement. But eventually, after 150 years, now there's not that many people now around who still believe that the whole universe revolves around the planet. But these kind of shifts in awareness don't happen that quickly. Now, with mindfulness and meditation, particularly in the West, you know, it really started to kind of be talked about in the West maybe 20, 30 years ago, you know, especially around in the 60s. You know, the Beatles went to see the Maharishi in India and he taught them transcendental meditation. But it was partially linked as well to the kind of hippie culture, to people getting stoned, and there was a bit of an association with it about, you know, being for dropouts, you know, yeah, meditate, dropout man, you know, zoning out. And a lot of kind of people on the planet who saw themselves as kind of more driven or more intellectual or more clever or whatever kind of have been writing meditation and mindfulness off a little bit as being for losers. Now, of course, for 4,000 years, people did not need modern science to tell them that mindfulness and meditation worked. They didn't need modern science to tell them anything. They had their own kind of science, if you like, and that's 4,000 years of experience. 4,000 years, however many, you know, that's got to be 100 plus 200 generations or however many generations of people it is, but lots and lots of human beings benefiting from mindfulness meditation practices, spreading that knowledge, passing that knowledge on humans, learning from each other based on personal experience. It's actually the most effective way to learn is to experience something. But more recently now, the West kind of loves to have science. It's got to be proven scientifically, otherwise I'm not going to bother doing it. I don't believe it. It's, you know, it's mumbo jumbo. No, that kind of thing doesn't work for me. Surely a bit of meditation and mindfulness isn't going to improve my health. I mean, it's ridiculous. So what I'm going to talk through now is some of those different aspects of science, particularly now, that have been explored around this. So there's been some amazing research in the last 10, 15 years now. Actually, the leading universities of the world, some of the leading scientists of the world have been doing experiments around mindfulness meditation, particularly using fMRI scans, functional magnetic reasoning imaging scans, I think it is, stands for, something like that. And they've done lots of research on different aspects and benefits of mindfulness and meditation. In fact, there's been a big research study on the US Marines, actually. They did a mindfulness program on Marines and then tracked how they were in battle and actually how it affected them. And they found it gave them a much better cognitive ability to make better reasoned decisions whilst suffering, obviously, quite extreme levels of stress. They've done research with the Dalai Lama and other people who have been meditating for, you know, 35 years and shown that there can actually be quite significant differences to the electrical activity and actually even the structure, the physical structure of the brain through a long-term meditation practice. But of course, none of us have here have been meditating. I don't think any of us here have been meditating for 35 years. And I think what we're more interested in is, well, okay, I'm not going to be able to do 35 years, but, you know, what about if I start meditating now? Is it going to make a difference? Am I too late? Have I kind of, you know, missed the ball as such? Well, they've also done research now that says, actually, no, our brain is elastic at all parts of our life. And they've actually done some research that now shows by just doing a short amount, they actually did it with half an hour of meditation a day for 2 weeks. And when they did that in a controlled scientific experiment with a control group, taking into account all the other possible factors, they found just by doing half an hour meditation for 2 weeks made a difference that could be highlighted on an fMRI scan, different triggering of electrical impulses in different parts of the brain. And then they actually found with 8 weeks meditation, there was actual structural changes happening to the physiology of the brain, actually physical structural changes just with 8 weeks meditation. And what they also found as well, it's not just about the brain being different when you're meditating. It's about the brain creating changes that are actually still there when you're not meditating. Because that's really what's the fundamental thing is, you know, we're not meditating just for the sake of meditating. We're meditating for a short, formal period of time so that it affects the rest of our life. We want to create structural changes and electrical changes in the brain that actually are applicable to all of, you know, our whole life. We don't just want to be zen when we're sitting in meditation. We want to be happy and calm and relaxed and resilient and, you know, all of those benefits we talked about yesterday during the whole day. So how does this work? Okay, well, there's a few different areas here we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about neural plasticity, metacognition, emotional intelligence, and epigenetics. My four favorite topics. What an interesting topics, not. Yes, I love this stuff. I love the science of this stuff. So neuroplasticity, this has been around scientifically for about 15, 20 years. So up until then, science used to teach that pretty much after adolescence, our brains were hardwired, and that was it. Your brain was hardwired for your whole adult life. Nothing you could do about it. We now know that's not true. That's completely not true. Whoever said you can't teach old dogs new tricks, rubbish. Absolute rubbish. You can. You can teach old dogs new tricks at any time. Our brains are elastic all the way through our life. Our brains can always be changed at any point in our life. And the way neuroplasticity works is we practice firing patterns of neurons, patterns of behavior, patterns of thoughts, which create electrical impulses, patterns of electrical impulses in our mind. And by firing those patterns over and over again, we create a compound called myelin. And that compound called myelin forms a sheath around the axon of the neuron. The axon's a little bit, the neuron's the cell, the axon's the bit that comes out of the cell. It creates a sheath around those axons. And eventually, when you fire that same pattern, those same neurons, those same axons, getting fired and fired and fired, you create more and more of that compound called myelin, and you create broadband connections in your mind. That's what it is. It's neurons that fire together, wire together. You fire particular patterns, you create particular patterns. And of course, once you've got those broadband connections, the electrical impulses like to travel down the easier routes. So the electrical impulses like to travel down those broadband connections. And they become your habitual patterns. That's how you get habitual patterns. You create stronger neural pathways in your brain. Now, of course, we go through life not being conscious of creating these habitual patterns. They're just being created almost on an autopilot kind of level. One of the ways you can imagine it, an analogy I like to use is of a vehicle crossing the desert. if you imagine you've got a big four-wheel drive and you've got a beautiful flat desert in front of you, and you drive down any path you choose for the first time, and you make some tracks in the desert. The next time you traverse the desert, you can either go down those little tracks, or you can go down them and turn off at any point, because they're only, you know, a centimetre deep. They're not really controlling your car. But if you choose to go down that same path over and over again, driving down those tracks, you'll make deeper and deeper ruts in the road. And eventually those ruts will be so deep that actually it's really hard not to go down that path. In fact, it's the only path you can really go down. And actually to try and get off that path, you'd have to drive out of ruts that deep and your car just wants to go down there. In fact, you don't even have to steer. You can take your hands off the steering wheel because it's just going to go down those ruts anyway. So this is how neuroplasticity affects our conditioning. And I talk about four stages to this this conditioning. Yeah. 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 Very good question. That's what I'm going to answer now. Perfect timing. Good. Good segue there. Okay. So we start off with unconscious bad habits. So this is our starting point. So these are the habitual patterns, those ruts, if you like, that are in the road, those deep ruts, those deep habitual patterns that are unhealthy. They're not serving us. We could just keep going down this path, and you know what? We're not even aware of it. That's the starting point. We're not even aware we're on a rut. We're not even aware we're driving the car. We're just sitting in the car and it's going down these ruts and we're not even realizing what's happening. So that's the starting point, unconscious bad habits. And then the first stage, so this is mindfulness. What we're doing with mindfulness, with yoga, with meditation, self-study, we're becoming aware and we're becoming conscious of those bad habits. So this is what mindfulness does. We're watching the patterns. We're watching the patterns of thoughts. We're watching our emotional reactions. We're watching how we respond to different things. We're becoming aware of those bad habits. We start to understand them for the first time. It might be a thinking habit. It might be a breathing habit. It could be a musculoskeletal moving habit. One I talk about is I used to work in an office for 16 years, and for 16 years I sat at my desk like that. My leg crossed over there, tap, tap, tapping away on the phone, on the computer. Completely unaware, unconscious, bad habit. And then actually when I started practicing yoga and meditation, I became aware. It's like, oh, I always sit that way. That's interesting. Interesting, I tried to sit the other way. I was like, I couldn't lift this leg up enough. This hip had got so tight, this hip had got so loose. But it was an unconscious bad habit that I became conscious of. But it could equally be a pattern of thought or a train of thought. When you start watching your thoughts, you start noticing them, and you might start becoming aware, oh yes, I'm always having those anxious thoughts about presenting, or about in social situations, or about money, or about lack of love, or whatever repetitive pattern of thoughts and emotions you have. You become conscious. And that's actually the hardest stage. That's definitely the hardest stage, actually, just becoming aware of your own patternings, your own habitual patterns. So you become aware of the ruts in the road. And number three, so rather than try and drive out of the bad ruts, if you like, rather than try and get out of them and think about those bad ruts anymore, we're not actually going to even think about those bad ruts. Instead, what we're going to do is consciously practice good habits. So there's a bit of a saying, that which you resist persists. You know, that which you give energy to persists even more. So rather than give those bad habits any energy, we're not actually going to do that, but we're going to consciously practice good, healthy habits. So this might be consciously practicing a particular thought pattern, consciously practicing feeling a particular emotion, consciously practice moving the body in a particular way, or consciously practice breathing in a particular way, consciously practicing good habits. And then through the process of neuroplasticity, through creation of the myelin around the axon of our neurons, we write those good habits into our programming, and they become unconscious good habits. And that's where we want to be. That's how we transform ourselves. That's how we change ourselves, a little bit at a time, chip, chip, chipping away, chip, chip, chipping away. It's not like we completely transform ourselves in one go, but we start to bring awareness to different habitual patterns. We start to consciously change different habitual patterns. It's not like we've each got one, you know, unconscious bad habit or one conscious good habit. You know, we're much more complicated, and there's lots and lots of different habits. But in theory, it's pretty simple. Four stages. One, two, three, four. We can all be perfect. If you're not already. Well, of course, we are all perfect already. But, you know, even more perfect. So, in principle, it is that easy. That's the four stages we do. But, of course, the human mind is complicated. It's the most complicated thing in the universe. And there's a few tendencies and nuances of the human mind that it's worth understanding. Because when you have an understanding of the tendencies of your own mind, or all of our minds are of human minds, and all of our minds can have the same tendencies. They've all evolved in the same way. Once you understand some of those tendencies, you can start to recognize the bad habits more easily. And there's five of these tendencies of the human mind. So the first one, which you might have experienced, is cravings. This is where we're trying to get certain things or becoming attached to certain things. This is basically how how the human mind works or has evolved to work, in terms of when something has given us some kind of physical pleasure or linked to a pleasurable emotion in the past, the human mind wants to continually seek out that thing and repeat it over and over again. It's the start of how all addictive behaviours happen. You know, of course, when we were cave people or when we were monkeys, it was quite beneficial that if we found some fruit, then, you know, we'd want to be craving that fruit because it might be about 4 weeks until we found the next piece. And, of course, linked to reproduction as well. It's important for the survival of the species to want to reproduce. But it can also not necessarily serve us very well, especially in the environment that we are in now. You know, we're living in an environment of abundance of particularly foods, for example, and stimulus. And we're not necessarily able to turn off our cravings. But it's important to just be aware of some of the things you find yourself craving for, and trying to understand where those cravings come from and the sensations linked to those. The opposite of cravings is aversions. So these are completely opposite. These are things that have caused us pain in the past, so we try and avoid them now, even though we don't necessarily know they're going to cause us pain. And again, you know, going back to the cave person example, if you've just had your leg bitten off by the saber-toothed tiger, you know, then that's going to cause you an aversion to saber-toothed tigers, and you're going to try and avoid them in the past, in the future. And that's a good thing. Now, that was a good thing. But, you know, now we're using these kind of responses. You know, say someone gets hurt by a boyfriend or something, and then, you know, that's it. I'm never going near another bloke again. You know, it's not necessarily a logical, reasonable aversion. The other one is the opposites of this could be obesity and anorexia. You know, one person is trying to avoid food, the other person is constantly craving food. You know, both of those habits can be harmful. They're opposite, but they're actually the same. So that's aversion and craving. So the third one, Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, it's whether you, if you do stop craving it, look, our bodies are designed to have a desire for that. That's been hardwired into our systems. I think what it's about not feeding the craving with more craving thoughts and creating a habitual pattern around that craving. So it's about, by not having it, you start to maybe observe those cravings more and actually learn to sit with those cravings, not reinforce those cravings. And by sitting with those, you kind of rise above them. And then the more you rise above them, the less their kind of power comes. So it's about just reinforcing a new habitual pattern. But, you know, those cravings for sugars and fats and things are, you know, pretty much hardwired into our physiology. But it's about how our patterns of our mind work around them. Yeah. Look, it's about awareness of the triggers within ourselves. It's about observing the sensations or the cravings without becoming a slave to the sensations and cravings. And it's about understanding there's different levels of consciousness. Which we'll go through a bit more in a minute, and it's about understanding that there's this higher level. And in fact, this brings me to the next thing, which is the ego or the egoic mind. This is the kind of part of the mind that likes to identify with things. This is the habit of the human mind that likes to say, "I," you know, I am a teacher. I am a man. I am a Australian. I am, you know, I am Tori's husband. I'm the father of three kids. I am rich. I'm poor. You know, I'm healthy. I'm not healthy. I'm happy. I'm sad. I'm this. I'm that. I am. We love to identify with different things, and that's a habit of the human mind. It's a habit of the human mind that we cannot live without, unless you're going to go and sit in a cave for the next 20 years, which, of course, some spiritual disciplines and traditions do encourage. They say, yes, to be completely enlightened and stuff, you've got to go and sit in a cave for 20 years. You've got to give up all your material possessions. You've got to give up your wife, your family, and go and sit in a cave. I'm like, sorry, Tori, sorry, kids, I'm going to the cave for 20 years. Just run the business without me. I'll be back in 2023 or whatever. But I'm not trying to encourage that, basically. But it's about understanding the tendency of the human mind to want to identify with things, because it's the identification with those things, whether it's a craving, whether it's a feeling, whether it's a profession, they're all things that are called form. They all form things. And it's the identifying with those things that causes us our suffering and our problems. Because those things are always changing. Those things are always unpredictable. That's the one thing we know about this world, that we can, in fact, the only thing we can predict is that it's constantly changing. And through our process of meditation and mindfulness, we start to practice just letting go of some of those identifications. Not disowning our family and disowning, you know, all of those things, but just realizing what we really are. This is what it comes down to. What am I really? What am I? What is the I? You know, now, of course, this is quite a large topic of conversation that's been covered, you know, for thousands and thousands of years. It's probably one of the, you know, the biggest questions that we can ask as a conscious creature. You know, what am I? What is the I? What really is it? And this is one of the things we contemplate and come to understanding through meditation. We start to realize, well, we're not our job. You know, we could lose our job and not still exist, you know. You know, you're not really your job. You're not really your family. I mean, again, you could lose your family. They could walk out on you. You could get divorced. The kids could disown you. You'd still exist. Or, you know, maybe I'm this body. Well, actually, you're not really a body either. You know, you could lose one arm, two arms, you'd become a quadriplegic, all kinds of things could happen to your body and you would still exist. And then maybe you think, well, okay, I must be my thoughts. That's what must the I be. I must be all the things that are swirling around my mind all the time, those thought patterns that I recognize. But actually through meditation, you start to have this awareness, this mindfulness in between thoughts. It's like, well, hang on, I had a thought there, and then I had this bit of space, and then I had another thought. But I still existed in between the thoughts. It's like, damn, I can't be the thoughts, because I still existed in between the thoughts. And so you start to come to the realization, or the conclusion, that the I is just the awareness. The I is just the conscious awareness. That's really what we are. That's the real true identity of what we are, the awareness within the mind. Whatever, you know, the consciousness, of course, is one of the big unanswered scientific things. No one's understood yet how all of those electrical impulses and physiological processes create this experience, this sense of experience that we have. But we know really that is our true self. That's really all we are, is that awareness, that conscious awareness. And the great thing about identifying with that awareness as the true self is that all of the stuff, all the turbulence, all the crap, all the drama, all the things that's invariably constantly changing in the world doesn't affect you as much. It doesn't affect you. It doesn't create the turbulence. As I said yesterday, the second Yoga Sutra, Chitti Vritti Nirodha Yoga, is the cessation of the fluctuations of the mind. You know that, oh, yes, I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm healthy, I'm not healthy, I'm rich this week, oh, no, I'm feeling poor this week. All of those fluctuations. When we practice our meditation, our mindfulness, we slow down those fluctuations. So the next thing is metacognition. Metacognition. So this is the knowledge of our own cognitive processes. So it's very much the same, but it's called the science of metacognition. So this is the science of watching our thoughts, of actually trying to observe our thoughts, of being the one that understands these thoughts being secreted from the brain, basically, these electrical impulses. We're not trying to stop those thoughts, but we're trying to just observe them. And when you observe those thoughts, you start to realize they're not facts. They're just thoughts. It doesn't matter. They just come into existence. They don't have to be treated as fact. You can almost have a bit of a laugh at some of the thoughts that come into your head. They're not you either. But your thoughts are not you. And having some separation from those thoughts can actually help you not be affected by those thoughts as much. So basically what initially was subjective, you know, I am happy, I am clever, becomes objective. Ah, look at that thought that said, I am happy. Or the thought becomes like an object that you understand. You realize that thought is not you. And this is really the difference between the consciousness and the thinking mind. The consciousness being the highest level of what we are, and the thinking mind being the thing that generates those thoughts and the patterns. An interesting subject that I'm fascinated in, and it does get talked about a little bit, is what would we be like without language? It's very hard to think without language. When you think about what's going on in your mind, often it's words. It's words and language being repeated and repeated. And certainly the development of language has definitely had an effect on how our mind works and thinks. And I think a lot of the issues we're having now is caused by the fact we've got these language, these words going around in our mind. It's very hard to, think without language. You can feel without language, but you can't really think without language. So the next one is emotional intelligence. So this is banded around quite a bit. This is where you start to understand that your thoughts and your emotions are completely and totally linked. you know, again, we got into a bit of a society where, you know, it's like this was seen as not linked to the mind. It was the mind and everything else. But emotional intelligence is the ability to observe one's own emotions, to discriminate between them, and to use them to guide you. So to really understand your own emotional processes. So this works through thoughts create neuropeptides. That's what happens when you have those electrical impulses. They create neuropeptides, actually a chemical in the brain. Those neuropeptides get distributed throughout your body, within your bloodstream, and they trigger hormonal responses from the hormone sensors. I've got a list of all the things that hormones do. I'm going to read this out because I don't remember this. But hormones, they stimulate or inhibit your growth, your mood swings, your induction or suppression of programmed cell death, activation or inhibition of the immune system, regulation of the metabolism, preparation of the body for mating, fighting, fleeing, and other activity, preparation of the body for a new phase of life, such as puberty, parenting, and menopause, control of the reproductive cycle, hunger, cravings, and sexual arousal. So, quite serious stuff there. You know, it's quite important stuff that's being triggered, and that is triggered by those neuropeptides as well, by the thoughts that happen in your mind. So, what happens is that thoughts create feelings, they create emotions. Chemical feelings. But those feelings also can create thoughts. So we can get locked into a cycle. Thought creates feeling, feeling creates thought. Thought creates feeling, feeling creates thought. And you can get locked into this cycle of thinking, feeling, unless you bring mindfulness to the process, where you raise yourself a little bit above that and you observe that pattern happening. You observe a thought, and you observe the sensation, the electrical charge, the emotional charge linked to that thought. You feel it. It's like, oh, I had that thought, and oh, I had that feeling. Oh, and look, all that feeling is kind of triggering that thought. But actually, with all these things, just by bringing awareness to it, you actually tend to calm the process anyway. So it's about that, trying to understand how those patterns get created. It's really the difference between observing the emotions or becoming the emotions. It's quite a fundamental difference. This is the subjective-objective thing again. So an example of becoming the emotion would be someone pisses me off, someone does something I don't like, I feel this anger and I'm getting really angry and I'm shouting now and I just want to bloody punch this person now because they're really got me angry and I'm like clenched and I got blood pumping around me. That's becoming the anger. It's the same with all different emotions. That's becoming the anger. The other way, the mindfulness way is, okay, someone's doing something to annoy me. Oh, feel that anger rising in me. Whoa, where did that come from? Oh, that's interesting. Oh, what's going to happen to that now? Oh, maybe I'll just focus on my breath. Breathing in, breathing out. Oh, cool. It's all okay. It's that much difference. It's that much difference. It's been about being you, the I, being in control of your emotions versus the emotions being in control of you. It's rising above them. It's about the I becoming a heightened state of intelligence, of consciousness. It's about you know, we're all evolution in process. You know, the whole human species is evolution in process. But all of us individually are evolution in work as well. We could all become more or less evolved. And, you know, we all know people who are less evolved, who we'd say was a bit more primitive, you know, who works on those primitive fears and desires controlled by the limbic, the more primitive part of the brain. We all know more primitive people. Or you can consciously try and be the most evolved you can be within your lifetime. And that's really by being mindful of your consciousness and raising your awareness to those higher, the most evolved parts of the mind and the brain, rather than becoming those emotions. It's the difference between living in survival is the primitive part, where you're being controlled by the lower primitive limbic parts of the brain, driven by fear and worry and selfish behaviours, or living in creation, which is living in the prefrontal cortex. And it's about, when you live in that prefrontal cortex, your thinking creates your feelings. Your feelings don't create your thinking. And that's quite a fundamental thing, for your thinking, your conscious thinking, to create your feelings, rather than just let this kind of primitive part of you create all the feelings. It's emotional intelligence. And then lastly, epigenetics. So epigenetics is a fascinating topic. And it's about genetics, of course. Epi means above. So epigenetics is the science of study of things that control your genetics above your genetics. So, of course, we've only really understood genetics for, it's nothing really, 80 years, 100 years, really, the study of genetics. So it's very, very new. And there was a bit of a trend, which still exists really, into believing that we are completely at the mercy of our genetic inheritance. It's like, I've got my DNA, that's it, nothing I can do about it, Bad luck, Paul. If I've got bad DNA, I've just got bad DNA, It's my bad DNA causing my depression. It's my bad DNA causing my anger. It's my bad DNA causing my heart disease. It's my bad DNA causing my cancer. Just, what can I do? No point me doing anything for it. It's out of my control. And there is a bit of that mentality around, still. That's still around. But we've actually known scientifically for quite a long time, actually, for about 10, 15, 20 years, really, that actually that's not the case. We certainly are born with genetic tendencies. Absolute for sure. We're born with faulty DNA strands. Absolutely true. But the difference is that the environment that we create within our body has a fundamental impact on which of those genetic tendencies get expressed. So just because we've got a genetic characteristic doesn't mean it's going to be expressed. And that's the fundamental thing. It's the environment around actually the cells in the body that decide or play a big role in whether those genetic tendencies get expressed. It's also about how much you repair your DNA. Now, we can actually repair our own DNA. We don't do this consciously, but we do this by going into the rest and digest mode. It's the opposite of the fight and the flight mode. It's the intelligence, the incredible intelligence that's within every one of us. And our cells know how to repair DNA, but there has to be triggered a hormonal chemical response that says, okay, we're in rest and digest mode now. Go off body and do the healing. Get the digestive system working again. Do all of the things that the body's great at doing. But that doesn't happen if we're living 90% of our life in the stress response mode. So this is really the danger of stress, is that when we're constantly triggering the stress response, the cortisol, the adrenaline, we're not doing the repair work that's needed to our body. There's a chap called Bruce Lipton, who's written a book called The Biology of Belief, highly recommended. And he talks about how the thoughts create these neuropeptides. The neuropeptides get distributed around the body, trigger different hormonal responses. And those chemical reactions going on around the body, they get distributed in the blood, and they form an environment around the cells of the body. That's what happened, and it's that environment around the cells that triggers the response, the genetic response in the cells. And here's another vehicle analogy. I like my vehicle analogies. And his analogy is that a lot of people in life, they see this as a vehicle, a car, if you like, and they see themselves as sitting on the back seat. They see themselves as passengers, and they see that their genetics are driving their health and well-being. It's nothing to do with them. I'm just sitting here on the back seat. My genes, my DNA, that's what's triggering all of the different things happening in my life. I can't do anything about it. Where actually the reality is we are actually all, or those people are actually driving the car, the vehicle, but they don't know they're driving. It's a really bad combination when you think about it, to be driving a car but not to actually know you're driving. My five-year-olds do this sometimes when I let them sit on my lap, and they say, me steer, and they're holding the steering wheel, and I'm like, okay then. And then they kind of forget they're driving, you know, and they start looking around and let their hands off. And this is what a lot of people are in. They're driving this vehicle, but they're not aware they're driving this vehicle. They might have, you know, 1 foot flat on the accelerator, another foot flat on the brake. They're looking around. They haven't got their hands on the wheel. They're not changing the gear, or they're not changing the gear properly. They're not letting off the clutch smoothly. They're spinning the engine. They're not noticing the smoke bellowing out of the bonnet or the oil dripping out of the back axle. They've never got it serviced. They never take it in for a service period. They don't do any regular maintenance on it. It's no wonder the vehicle's clapped out and completely trashed. They haven't given it any conscious attention. And where we want to be with this is we want to be conscious drivers of this vehicle. We want to be consciously taking care of this vehicle, doing the servicing, accelerating nicely, but also braking, making sure we park the vehicle properly at night and turn the engine off, making sure we change the oil, we, you know, have regular rest periods, you know, just putting some effort into servicing the vehicle. And actually, as with cars, if you service the vehicle and you look after it, it will give you a lifetime of pleasurable driving, absolute lifetime of pleasurable driving. But if you don't, you'll constantly have problems, constantly have problems. So this is what we're trying to do with our mindfulness. We're trying to bring mindful awareness to ourselves as the drivers of these vehicles. Any questions? You're not going to get any handouts, but you will get a PDF. So you will get a PDF, yeah. So I'll send you a PDF email. There will be some links to some of the written stuff, but mainly it'll be the MP3s. So there'll be MP3s, so you can listen to any of this again. I'll also send you the links as well to all the different people who have inspired me. So, you know, surprise, surprise, I didn't actually make any of this up myself. I've stolen all of this information from other people. So people like Richard Davison, he's a PhD professor of psychology, John Kabat-Zinn, very much into mindfulness, Eckhart Tolle, Michael Chaskerson, and Peter Russell, a British scientist that really examines what consciousness is. Actually, he actually says basically consciousness is in everything. Consciousness is in every atom. On a subatomic level, everything is consciousness. But it's different levels of consciousness. Now, of course, the rock does not know it's conscious. The single cell doesn't necessarily know it's conscious. But actually, there's intelligence, of course, in a single cell, because it's doing things which require intelligence or some kind of know-how. And as you go up to the most evolved creatures, living things, which are humans, that consciousness has reached a new level. And of course now what we're experiencing is the consciousness has become aware of itself. The consciousness is aware of the consciousness. There's a great, there's a great video actually, Peter Russell talking about what is consciousness. Bruce Lipton, All About the Biology of Belief, is a PhD microbiologist. Often the people, they tend to be particle physicists, you know, microbiologists. That's really where a lot of the science is coming out. You know, quantum physics, all that kind of science as well. String field theory and particle field theory. We're starting to live at a time, you know, where kind of science and kind of what's traditionally been seen as spirituality are coming together. It's quite an exciting time to actually live. We're starting to understand the universe and things that people have known about for thousands of years, but have put it down to spirituality or gods or something like that. But we're actually starting to understand the science of it. And the unified field theory is really the pinnacle of that, because, you know, you might argue that the unified field is God. Unified field is when you, I don't know if you know, if you look at everything on a smaller and smaller and smaller basis and you start looking at things on a subatomic quantum level, there's actually virtually nothing there. This is the huge paradigm thing we're trying to grapple with at the moment. So if you imagine this room was a cell, a single cell, the nucleus in the middle of the cell would be like, you know, like about like that big. And the electrons, in fact, probably even smaller than that, actually, probably more even so. And the electrons popping in and out of existence would be like little specks of dust. The vast 99.9% of every one of your of those subatomic atoms is empty. And it, you just have to start thinking about actually what that really means. Is actually when you look around, I know it all looks solid and it all kind of feels solid, but actually that's actually just a manifestation in our mind. That's actually just an impression that's created on our mind. Actually, fundamentally, we know that everything is just vibrating bits of energy, basically. That's what the science is telling, quantum physics. That's what Einstein basically discovered, that everything is just vibrating energy. And to keep reminding yourself, sometimes I'd be driving down the road and I try and remind myself that, and it sends shivers down my spine sometimes when I'm driving down the road thinking, hang on, this is actually all just vibrating energy. Everything's completely linked by these electrons. It's just like a field of energy, basically, which, depending on how it vibrates, forms these different things that we see, and we create these images of form on the back of the mind. I digress. Joe Dispenza talks all about the science of changing your mind. Michael DeManico is my yoga teacher who got me into yoga. He studies really yoga from the Yoga Sutras, the philosophy and psychology of yoga. The Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, that document. Stephen Hawkins, the British professor of mathematics at Oxford University, has got some awesome perspectives on life and God and consciousness. So I'll send you a list of all those people and the different books and stuff. And you know, what I've tried to do is, in this course, is aggregate all of that information from all of those different people and hopefully present it in a way that can benefit us. You know, there's no point learning all of this stuff if it doesn't bring us benefit. That's really what it's about.